Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 7, delivered on February 13, 2017. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates in Theory and Use.
Today, Interest Rates in Theory and Use. And I'm coming back through it again because this is where the book brings it up. They still don't do everything that I wanted you to know, so that's why I have to make that more, that fuller presentation in the second week. But again, just to start off, interest rates, you can describe them and give them a definition in different ways. So if I were to ask you on an exam, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, what is an interest rate? You could actually approach the answer from several different angles. Now, on the one hand, interest rates represent an opportunity cost of capital. Remember that core interest rate is the opportunity cost of just pure foregone consumption. But broadly speaking, the entire interest rate with all of its pieces in place would be an opportunity cost of capital. But also, an interest rate is actually a rental rate as well. An interest rate represents the rental rate on money. That's kind of an interesting thing right there. Borrowing money is the same as renting it. It's just like I do not, if I hire you, I am not buying you, I am renting your intellectual or physical services, okay? And the same is true with money. It has a rental rate, and the interest rate you pay is the rental rate on money. There are other ways that I can think of interest rates too, but these are kind of important ones for us in finance to consider. Now, I want to take you on a slight journey, and if I can find the original article, I will put this to you. Put it as a link. Certainly not required, but you can read this article, and at the end there's a comment I made on the article, and it didn't get much traction. I think they actually deleted my comment. But here's the deal. Traditionally, what would you consider, let me start with this, what would you consider to be a reasonable interest rate for borrowing money? You need a loan of $1,000. What would you consider to be a reasonable rate for that?
As less as possible.
Well, boy, that was good. I want a number.
1%.
Well, how much?
1%.
Dream on. It ain't going to be 1%. But in this interest rate environment, actually, interest rates are low. And a reasonable rate to borrow money, if you got you can get a personal loan at a bank probably or a credit union in the 8 to 10% range right now. But the question is, what is wrong with people who pay interest rates of 25%, 50%, 100% for money? Are they irrational for doing that? What is wrong with a person who will not put away $100 for a year at an interest rate of 8%? Why do we have people who would rather spend their money now than save for their retirement? The problem is that there's a big fight going on in finance that Most finance professionals say, well, this is just irrationality on the part of poor people. They'll go to payday loan and they'll wipe out their future just so they can have some money for tomorrow, today and tomorrow. That's just purely irrational. We have to force them to accept reality, that they have to save money, that it's good for them, and all of that. Well, unfortunately, for a lot of people, our interest rate theory just doesn't hold. And no matter how much we call them irrational, no matter how much we put a fist of state-imposed savings plans, retirement, health insurance on them, they're going to try to find a way out from under it. Because interest rates, as I define them for you, don't really apply to a very large number of people who are in the lower income and lower classes of this country and every country on earth. So anyway, with that in mind, I want to take an aside here just for a few minutes to talk about money. Before we go any further, if I'm going to talk about interest rates and say interest rates are the rental rate on money, I should probably be a little more specific about it, what money is. Okay, now let's start with this. What is money?
Something that you can use in exchange for a good or service.
Mm-hmm. You can. Okay, so in other words, if I have apple pies and you have just killed a moose, I can give you some apple pies and you can give me a moose, right?
I mean, that'd be like a barter.
Well, no, doesn't matter. Is it money? Is a moose money? To a certain extent, yes. The one thing that we would have to qualify is that it has to be somewhat more broadly accepted than just between you and me. It might be the case that no one else likes my pies and no one else likes your moose. Have you ever had moose? It is rather strong meat. I mean, it tastes, you know what it tastes like? It tastes like moose. I mean, you eat it and the first thing that comes to your mind, moose. Okay? My father used to hunt moose until a bull moose took him out almost one day, and that was the end of his hunting of moose. Turns out the moose didn't want to die that day. It has to be, money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Now, I've already gone through this, I think, with you, but I want to emphasize it. That there is, the first kind of money is barter money. Barter money is a thing. It has full intrinsic value. It can be exchanged, but it can be used fully. You can fully use that pie. I can fully use every part of that moose. Well, not every part, that's just weird. Okay, but barter money has full intrinsic value. Full. The next kind of money is commodity money. Sometimes called metal money, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a metal per se. But commodity money is money that is like gold, silver, platinum. It has some intrinsic value. It can be used in limited ways. But there has to be a general understanding that this is something that people like or that has things that can be done with it. For example, gold actually kind of sucks as a weapon for making weapons, but it does have a very nice surface to it and it is very attractive. It also is pretty darn good for certain things where you need a metal that has a low melting temperature and is rather malleable. Hence why gold was very popular very early on for filling cavities. And it's still to this day a very popular thing for teeth because of some of its properties. But commodity money does not have full intrinsic value, but it still has intrinsic value. I could take a silver coin and pound it down into a spearhead. Or, as was done, some kinds of metal money were melted down for musket balls in
wars of the last couple of centuries and bullets and all that. So commodity money is something that has some intrinsic value to itself. Next one is fiat money or fiat money. Fiat or fiat. It is money that is money only by decree of the sovereign. It is only by decree of the sovereign that you can... And sir, I would like you to read me that statement right there on the $1 bill.
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Exactly. In other words, this can be used by law, by decree of the sovereign of the United States. It has no value on its own, per se. You could use it for toilet paper, I suppose. But other than that, it's certainly not as good as Charmin, I'll tell you that. Ask any bear, which he would prefer. But it exists only because the sovereign has said this exists as a tradable commodity. It has no intrinsic value at all, or only a tiny bit. There's something called... what's the term they use? Seigniorage. That there's a tiny little bit of value, the cost of the linen paper and all of that, that they actually keep account of in the government that kind of carries like a par value on us. Sometimes you'll see old stock certificates that have like par value 0.0001 cent per share. It's that kind of thing right there. There is now another kind of currency, new to the world, completely new. And they don't even mention, I don't think I've seen any finance textbooks. One of the first things I look for when these publishers come in, show me their textbooks, I look for a couple of standard things, and then I look for this one. If any of them are mentioning in economics or in finance, crypto, the cryptocurrencies. The most famous of them is Bitcoin, but there are others out there too. Cryptocurrencies exist only electronically. They have absolutely, purely zero intrinsic value. They do not exist as a physical object whatsoever. In no way, shape, or form is there anything there except for an electronic hash that was acquired by whoever got it. Are any of you familiar with Bitcoin at all? A few of you are. I'm going to bring in some Bitcoin hashers. There's a hasher's den here in town. And I'll bring in a Bitcoin hasher to the club that I advise probably in November and let them explain to you what this world of cryptocurrencies is about and the war that's going on between the governments of the world and the cryptos who are running the hashes on them, and how it ebbs and flows back and forth, but how it's going to go to the cryptocurrencies, and it's going to be a long transition, probably into the second half of the 21st century. The fight will go on, maybe even longer than that, but cryptos will come to dominate currencies in the world of the future. There was an attempt to do cryptos in the 1990s, several big companies tried to sponsor their own cryptos, and it didn't exactly work. Kind of flopped. What was the one Amazon did? It was called Amazon Pocket Wallet or something. I can't remember what it was, but they tried one in the early 1990s, a crypto, their own proprietary cryptocurrency. And probably a lot of it was just not enough people knew about the internet at that time, and there was certainly no comfort zone in the internet for people who weren't true geeks like me. But it's going to be a little bit more important. And anyway, if you're interested, I'll be giving you an announcement in a few weeks about when I'll bring in the hashers. And if it's okay with the guys I know, I'll take you over to the hasher's den. Essentially, what's going on in cryptocurrencies is you're running on a very powerful gaming computer. You're just drinking electricity, powering it, searching for, trying to be the first one to find the encryption for a Bitcoin. You do it, it's your coin, and then it goes into your cryptocurrency account. If you're not, well, you go on to the next one, and you just crank and crank and crank 24/7, capturing these coins as you can. It's sort of like a video game, except it's very real because there's a lot of money involved. But anyway, that's money. Now, the next thing. And I'm going through some things that I've already talked about before. I just want to make sure that you know. Liquidity. Liquidity. Liquidity is the ease with which, or the efficiency with which, one asset can be turned into another asset. That's liquidity. The higher the liquidity, the more efficient the exchange can be. So, for example, you see this? Well, actually, it'd take a couple of these. Okay? I can go up to the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A, and I can get a Chick-fil-A sandwich. Okay? Instantly, I can turn these into a sandwich. That, in other words, this is highly liquid. This is the most liquid. This is a fiat. Interestingly enough, the one thing about fiats and cryptos is that they are generally extremely liquid currencies. Because essentially they don't have any value, so you don't have to figure out what they're worth. You know what they're worth based upon rules of, or the rules of exchange. Okay. However, you, madam, have a really nice house trailer on the east side of Rockford. Indeed. And you would like to have a Chick-fil-A sandwich. And you go up, I'd like to exchange my trailer for a sandwich. It's not going to happen, is it? Certainly there is a lot of value in that trailer. I mean, it's got to be at least $300, $400. I mean, with that skirt you put around it and all that. I know, right? So, but they're still not going to give you a sandwich right away for it. You'd have to sell the trailer, get some of this, and then go and get it. You are, okay. I shan't touch you because that would be harassment, but I want you to look at him. If I were to move him back and forth, would he go blue, blue? No. You know what that means? You are not liquid. You're looking back and forth like. In other words, he has an extraordinary amount of value, probably $6 to $10 million of present value of his future expected cash flows. He is actually a highly valuable asset. However, he is about as illiquid as an asset can get. Because, I mean, there's going to be value, but it would come over time very slowly from him. And it would be extraordinary value. And it is value that I can actually develop. You're here to actually increase your value. I can actually make this value higher, or you can. Okay? But I can't. You can't exchange yourself for a sandwich. Right? If it's a good sandwich, you'll sell yourself for it. No. But the thing, though, is that liquidity is a measure, but there is one thing. Higher liquidity, less investment return. This is a general rule, general rule. Lower liquidity, more investment return. In other words, and I talked about this when we're doing talking about ratio analysis. If I have a lot of money that is highly liquid, cash and marketable securities, That means that I am relatively safe from immediate demands on my cash flow. I can pay bills right away. But at the same time, money like that isn't earning as much as it could if I were to put that money into, let's say, a factory or a new fleet of trucks or a new computer system or a couple of training seminars for my employees. In other words, there's a trade-off between liquidity and return. And you have to, in every company, that choice, that balance has to be decided. The next thing. Liquidity is related to a term that I have kind of tossed in and out, but I haven't explained why I use one at some times and another at other times. Money and capital. Sometimes I'll use them interchangeably, but I don't want to do that too often. Money is generally less than a year. Capital is more than a year. So if I go to a bank and I say, all right, I'm going to need some money, I'm going to need a loan to build up my inventory for the art season that's coming up in, starting in the spring, that would, I would be accessing a money market. I would be accessing a money market. A company that issues commercial paper, it's highly liquid, it's 30 days, just borrow a pile of money for 30 days for some quick project or some quick need, and then they pay it back. That's accessing a money market. However, if I sell stock to investors, those investors are with me forever. That's the ultimate in capital markets. I'm accessing a capital market. If I am a corporation that borrows $100 million on a 20-year bond issue, that I have accessed a capital market for that. When you took out that ridiculously expensive student loan, did you access a money market for that or a capital market?
Capital.
Bingo, a capital market. Now, interestingly enough, money markets and capital markets are actually reflections of each other in a very large sense. Like, for example, in the accounts of nations, I buy, you are... an oil vendor in Canada. I buy oil from you. American dollars flow into the Bank of Canada, and the Bank of Canada gives you the Canadian dollars in exchange. That is a money market transaction. Okay, highly liquid. However, there is a mirror reflection of that because Canada can't spend those American dollars, those U.S. dollars, anywhere but in the United States. So in the long term, Canada has to invest those dollars back here. That's how we've been able to afford to run these massive budget deficits and have these insanely low taxes and have these expensive programs like wars and all of that for so long. Essentially, when we buy cheap stuff from other countries in the money market, money flows to the banks of those countries, and then in the long term, those countries have to invest those dollars back here because they can't do it anywhere else, so they lend our government, lend our private citizens and our corporations money in the capital market. So there's a two-way flow back and forth. Interestingly enough, for a while, the government didn't want to show the trade deficits we were running. They were just ridiculous, these massive trade deficits. So what they did instead was show the other side of it, the capital market return of the money, showing that was skyrocketing. But it was just sort of a game that they were playing. Yeah, but that skyrocketing of capital investment in the United States is exclusively because we are running these massive trade deficits in the money markets. Anyway, money, when I say money, I'm talking about short term. When I say capital, I'm talking about long term. So companies earn revenue in the money markets. Companies earn their money in the money markets. But then at least to some extent, they grow by investing that in the capital markets. And then theoretically, as the company grows, it is able to sell more in the money markets, and that money flows back around, and the residual claim to the shareholders gets reinvested to grow in the capital markets, and then that causes more of our money to be earned in the revenues of the company. It's just the same cycle as in nations. We earn in the money markets, but our ability to earn in the money markets is because at the bottom line, once we've paid our bills, we've got money to reinvest in the capital market, from the capital markets, to grow our companies in the long run so that we can sell more in the money markets. Kind of an odd thing. Okay, down to nitty gritty. A couple of things here. I better write this back down on the board. Interest rates. An interest rate comprises the risk-free rate, which is, as I mentioned before, the real rate of return plus an expected inflation premium. Plus a risk premium, which has three parts. There is the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium. Or sometimes you'll hear me, I used to call it the liquidity premium, but this book calls it the illiquidity premium. Put those together and you have an interest rate. And the reason there are different interest rates for different things is because of these components right here. The case of D, the default premium would be different on, the default premium would generally be lower for anything that is backed, has collateral backing. Mortgages, things like that. Car loans. The maturity premium simply goes up as the length of the maturity length goes up on the instrument. It gets worse for all instruments of a given maturity when interest rates are more, there's less certainty about interest rates. And then the liquidity premium or the illiquidity premium is based on how easy it is for the lender to dump the security if he or she needs the money back quickly. Can the lender sell the debt instrument or sell the stock to if it's a stock equity? Can they sell it quickly? If they can, that illiquidity premium is very small. If they can't, then it gets a little bigger. Again, the warning there is that when you invest in penny stocks, one of the reasons they are so low in price is because of that high illiquidity premium. And that brings us to the next one. And again, this is somewhat review, but I got to make sure that you got this all in here. Price and yield are inversely related. Price goes down, price goes up, yield goes down. Price goes down, yield goes up. It's one of the most fundamental relationships in finance. Now a few technicals. Just a few technicals. Yield. Stated versus effective. The bulk of this little thing I want to show you here happened. The 1920s were called the Roaring Twenties. You had all manner of, in the financial world, you had all kinds of scams and schemes. Every loathsome con man, dog beater, cat strangler, child whipper was doing some kind of wretched scam to sucker people in and take their money. Now, this had been going on for decades, and there had been some efforts to put it under control, but there really hadn't been any effective end to it. Even the Federal Reserve, when the Federal Reserve was put into place in the 19-teens, it was just the same business as usual, really. Because our government was, quite honestly, the best government money could buy. And it had been. Now, we had a little bit of a reform period in the later 19-teens. We passed some strong antitrust legislation, amendments to the Sherman Antitrust Act. We passed some regulatory stuff. We even tried a couple of things internationally, which ended in fiasco with the Great War, later called World War I. But by the time we get to the 20s, it was just a heyday of all kinds of dirty deals and scams and schemes and all that. And there was always this cry, well, you know, you can't interfere in free markets. Free markets will solve their own problems because the bad guys will be found out and they'll be destroyed and the good guys will win in the end and the strong will survive, and that's what we want, is a country of strong financial people, just like we want a country of strong physical people, all that kind of stuff. That was the argument of the 1920s. Well, all of that came to an end on Black Monday in 1929 when the stock market crashed and all hell broke loose. But in its heyday, one of the things that was being done was offering ridiculous interest rates for investments. Ludicrous. Okay. Madam, I should like to have you invest in my project $10,000. And you will earn 40%. I know, but you're going to be lucky. You're on the ground floor of this. 40%, are you in? Well, of course you would be in because you didn't know better. And you were greedy, quite honestly. It's like the people who cried, Bernie Madoff screwed me. No, you were a greedy son of a bitch. You knew damn well that you were getting ridiculously higher than anyone else. What did you think? You were special? Okay, we're not going to say that to you. You're just an incredibly astute investor. Okay, so she's got 10%. She's going to earn 40%. So I've got to bring her in $14,000 in a year. Sir, okay, in a year, I need you to invest $20,000. And I'm going to be paying you 60% interest. Are you in? Of course you are. You give me $20,000, I give you back your $14,000, I pocket the difference, and then I wait for yours to mature, and I say, Madam, I should like $100,000, and I will pay you 100% interest in 1 year. Are you in? And you say, yes. I say, yes, what? And you say, yes, please. $100,000, I take care of you, and I pocket the difference when I pay her back. And now I've got a deal. You see how a pyramid scheme worked? This was exactly how they worked in the 20s. Up, 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 until kaboom, the whole thing fell apart, one after the other. And it all came to a crashing halt. Banks were doing this kind of crap, offering interest rates that were insane. And then when they needed to pay those off, they would just offer higher interest rates to people putting in new money. And of course, it all came, fell apart. What the hell? And then we had the election of 1932. And that was preceded by the crash of 29, masses of bank failures, and some horrible things like the bonus marchers, the butchering of the bonus marchers in 32, which I'll bet not one of you was taught in your what the U.S. troops did to a bunch of World War I crippled veterans who marched on Washington. But 32 election, the rascals were thrown out. I mean, they were thrown out hard. And a new era was put in, an era of very strong regulation. Regulation of labor markets, regulation of freeing up the unions, regulation of securities markets, stock markets, the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Federal Trade Commission was strengthened greatly in that time. And banking regulation was put into place, the strongest. The big, massive thing was called the Glass-Steagall Act. Glass-Steagall was the law of the land for decades. Interestingly enough, Glass-Steagall was repealed in the late 1990s. We don't need any more. Markets can take care of themselves. But anyway, the point was, that this long story comes down to this. One of the things that was laid out for banks, no more of this nonsense with these ridiculous interest rates. You are going to have a cap on interest rates, period. No more than a certain amount can you pay. Can you offer to pay? Can you even hint at paying? And the amount was 5.25%. That was the maximum that any passbook savings account could pay, 5.25%. Truth be told, because the money supply was being expanded so rapidly, interest rates were way, way below this. So this was what we would call in finance an ineffective price ceiling. It was a price ceiling, but it didn't matter because real interest rates were nowhere near this. It's sort of like saying you can't charge more than $4 a gallon for gas. That's a price ceiling. But if gas is selling for $1.96 a gallon, it's not effective. So realistically, this 5.25% didn't have any material impact at the time. Unfortunately, though, as time went on, it got a little bit more complicated. Because eventually the government started having to borrow money and had to start clawing back on the interest rate, on the money supply, and all of that kind of stuff. And interest rates in the economy began to move upward. And there were investments that were paying, reasonably safe investments, safe on the level of banks almost, were beginning to pay close to 5%, then 5.5%, then 6%. And the banks were saying, oh, we're stuck. You've got this law that says we can't offer more than this, and we're getting competed out for capital because no one's putting money into our savings account, the savings accounts in banks, because there are these things that are almost as safe that they can put them into and earn a little more. Well, here's how they pulled. Let me show you something. Suppose that I were to take $100 one year, okay? At compounded annually, $100 times 1 plus 0.0525 to the first power would, not surprisingly, get me $105.25. Divide that by the original 100, and you get 1.0525 minus the 1.0525 times 100%. Not surprisingly, you get 5.25%. Nothing complicated about that at all. But here's the trick. Watch. Suppose I do it again, except I do it compounded semi-annually. I'll have to use my calculator. Grab it. So I'll do 100 times 1 plus 0.0525 over 2 to the 2 times 1. Oh, goody. I forgot my calculator. I'll have to do it on my phone calculator. Really? Okay. 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2 equals, and then y to the x, 2 minus 1 equals. That would be $105.32. Divide that by 100. That's 1.0532 minus the 1.05532. I apologize. I should have just done it times 100. Done these before class. I can almost remember these. But the effective rate. Has now gone up to 5.32% just by compounding semi-annually. And if I do it quarterly, monthly, weekly, daily, it gets even better. So I can stay within the letter of the law, but I can sort of cheat and bump the interest rate up to a higher effective yield. This was how the compounding got popular. It was a way to stay within Glass-Steagall, but to also offer a sweetener to clients. Now, here's the formula for it. Okay, effective yield. Is just 1 plus the annual over the number of compoundings per year to the number of compoundings per year. You don't have to, don't use any money or any years. Don't use any of that, just 1 plus the annual. Okay, so let's look at this one. Suppose that we had an annual of 8%, okay? Okay. Number of compoundings per year. Now, be sure that you can do this and round correctly. Do it, if you have a calculator, do it with me, because the problems in the homework and the quiz and the test, they're going to hit you hard on accuracy, to 3 decimal places of accuracy, so make sure that you nail it, okay? So one compounding per year would be, minus one. I forgot on this formula is a subtract one. Don't forget to subtract one at the end. One compounding per year. That would be 1 plus 0.06 over 1 to the first power, which a minus 1, which would be 0.06, which is 6%. Two compoundings per year, 1 plus 0.06 over 2 to the second minus 1, which would be 1 plus 0.06 divided by 2, close parentheses, to the second power, minus 1 would be 0.0609, which would be 6.09%. That was almost a bump of 10 basis. That was a bump of 9 basis points just on semiannual compounding. Quarterly, 1 plus 0.006 over 4 to the fourth power minus 1 would be 1 plus 0.06 divided by 4, close parentheses, to the fourth power. And you get 0.06136, which is 6.136%, rounded to 3 decimal places. So as you can see, the interest rate is getting better the more compoundings per year. You can even, I don't know if any of you would ever actually experience it, but there is a special formula, which I won't show you. The book doesn't ask about it. But there's a different formula. You can go down to daily, hourly. There is even one that has instantaneous compounding. It uses an e to the x, and it's kind of more of a scientific calculation. But you can get compounding as fast as you want. And you probably would never see these incredibly high-speed compoundings, because those happen with accounts of extraordinarily rich people. For you, compounding generally quarterly, I think I saw a credit union where they were talking about their CDs were compounding monthly, but you know, faster than that, I don't think most normal people won't see those, but you can negotiate those if you have a lot of money, I guess. Anyway, that's the effective compounding formula. Now, the next thing. Okay. So, what does this mean? I did the quarterly there, okay? You invest $500 for 1 year at 6% compounded quarterly. Now you have two ways you can do it. The first way would be to say that the future value, oh no, let's say for 3 years. 3 years. Future value, you could do it the way I had shown you before, $500 times 1 plus 0.06 over 4 quarterly to the 3 years times 4 compoundings per year. There'll be a little bit of rounding error here when I do the next one. Okay, so what I would do is I'd get 500 times open 1 plus 0.06 divided by 4, close parentheses, to the 12th power. $597.81. Is that right? 3 years times four compoundings per year.
Okay.
Yeah. Three years. So there are a total of 12 periods of compounding. The formula is always future value equals present value times 1 plus k to the t power. K is the periodic interest rate. Which is the annual over the number of compoundings per year. Per year. The T is the number, total number of periods. of periods, which would be the number equals the number of years times the number of compoundings per year. So in other words, in this case, 3 years, a quarterly, would be 3 times 4, 12 compoundings on a year. And the interest rate, 6%, carved up 4 times a year they're doing this. So in other words, in each period, it would be 6% divided by 4, which would be 1.5%. Yeah, so I just do it in this way so you can see it expanded out. Is there some reason I can't see this? Well, oh, quit it. Get off. 597.81, rounded to dollars and cents. And again, watch it. They are that thing there in my finance lab is so picky about rounding. Okay. Or I could do it. Watch this not work. 500 times 1.06136 to the third power. There's one. The second one is off a little bit because I rounded the effective to 3. Now, I'm showing you this. It might take some of you might see it immediately what happens here. Others, it might take a while to think about. It's okay one way or the other. The thing that I'm showing you here is that an effective rate essentially corrects for the compounding periods per year. So that if you have the effective rate, you don't have to do the number of compoundings and all that kind of stuff. It's already done that for you. It's embedded in the effective rate. So that essentially it becomes just a normal annual rate. The effective rate is a normal annual rate taking into account the compounding, if the effect of compounding. And so again, the whole point of why this happened, it had been known for a long, long time before that. But the reason it became popular in banking was simply because it allowed for interest rates that were slightly higher than what would be allowed by law. But because the rate itself was still within the confines of the regulations and the law, it was allowed, and it just became sort of what we do. Sort of the normal thing. Now, here's the thing. There's a dark side to that. Suppose you go to a bank and you decide you want a car. You say, I'm going to buy a car. What are you going to charge me on a loan? Bank says, okay, well, interest rates are going up, but you've been a great customer. We're going to take care of you at 6.89% on the loan. Now, they can say that. Somewhere in the contract, they do have to disclose something else, that this is the stated rate. But you're going to make monthly payments. The effective rate on your loan is going to be 1 plus 0.0689 divided by 12 to the 12th power minus 1. That's going to be the actual effective rate on your loan. So in other words, it's a double-edged sword. If you are a saver, then compounding works to your benefit to boost your yield, your effective yield. If you are a borrower, the compounding, because your loan is being recalculated every month based on monthly payments, you have effectively created monthly compounding. And so, and I again strongly encourage you to make sure that you can do this on your own calculator. I mean, realistically, this is just like a scientific calculator thing. It's not a financial calculator thing. I would say, open parentheses, 1 plus 0.0689 divided by 12, close parentheses, y to the x 12 minus 1. Oh. That comes out as a percentage to be 7.11%. That's a little different, isn't it? A little different. And that, of course, there are accusations, the reason banks offer loans, car loans, and home loans at things like 0.99 and 0.89 and 0.79 is because they know that once compounding is taken into account, the effective yield boosts it into the next percentage zone, which they don't want the people to see. Now, by law, they have to disclose the effective yield. They actually do. But that's not what you're going to see in the advertisement. That's not what you're going to see when they talk to you about the loan that you're going to get. But it is actually what you're paying is something more. In this case, 11 and 11 is 22 basis points more than what the loan actually, what's advertised, what's stated to you. This gets worse the more... the higher the interest rate is, obviously. But it also, interestingly, becomes a stronger effect the more frequent your payments. Do you see that? If you say, I want to make my payments twice a month, you know, get this loan over with, you're actually going to have a higher effective yield on the loan you're paying. So keep that in mind when you think you're being smart. Yeah, you might be. Get the loan over with, but you're actually implicitly being financially punished by the greater compounding effect. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.